In a telegram sent January 15, 1918, Vladimir Lenin wrote, "For God's sake, take the most energetic and revolutionary measures to send grain, grain, and more grain." The Bolsheviks came to power chanting the slogan "Peace, Land, and Bread," but there was little of the latter available. Believing that the greedy peasants were hoarding all the grain, the Bolsheviks went to the countryside and forcibly seized it. The results were tragic. In this video, let us take a look at Soviet Russia's desperate, merciless campaign for grain. At the start of the 1900s, the Russian Empire was mostly agricultural. 80% of the people lived in the rural areas. Since relatively few people lived in the cities, not much surplus was necessary to feed the urbanites, about 7-8% of the annual crop. About 26% of the peasants' grain production, mostly wheat, was made available to be sold to the cities and exported to other countries through external markets at market prices. The export business was big. The Russian Empire was one of the world's biggest wheat exporters, and the government made a lot of money from it. They built a massive network of trains to bring that wheat from east to west. However, the seemingly thriving grain business hid a latent weakness. Not being particularly productive, the peasants can only grow enough to send to the external markets because they sacrificed their own personal consumption. If all those peasants ever changed their habits, like if they planted less grain or started consuming more grain themselves, then those surpluses can rapidly vanish, just because so many peasants were out there. The country suffered a massive and terrible famine in 1891 and 1892, but for 20 years after that, the weather was good, the system held, and the country suffered no serious food crises. That all changed after 1914, when World War I broke out. The grain harvest in 1915 and 1916 out in the agricultural areas had not been too bad, yet grain and food could not get to the urbanites in Moscow for two reasons: markets and distribution. After war broke out, the single market through which the government bought grain started to break down. To feed its 6 million-plus man army, the Russian Tsarist government started buying huge amounts of grains like oats directly from producers. They paid for this with borrowing and money printing. That diluted the currency, causing bread and oat prices to rise. So the government added price controls. Yay, everything is fixed, right? But artificially low prices without subsidies only made the grain producers withhold their surplus grain from the market. Instead, the peasants might sow less land or consume more of what they had by either eating it themselves, feeding it to their livestock, or making vodka out of it. The second major problem was that the transportation network started to break down due to shortages in working train cars and fuel. There was also bad weather and a growing number of bandits prowling the tracks. Expensive and unavailable bread prices caused the workers at the weaving mills and factory floors to go hungry. They started to protest, leaving their jobs to do so. What had once been a single, massive food market started to break down into many smaller markets. In response, the Tsarist government gave the Minister of Agriculture the job of procuring food for the entire country, army and nation combined, in other words, a food monopoly. Using these powers, the minister set up the first food requisition program to catalog and seize grain from the peasants. However, the peasants resisted, and the government backed down. The food shortages did not end the Russian Empire that had been fomenting for a long time, but it foretold what was to come. In February 1917, women filled the streets to protest food shortages and the war. The army garrison there refused to fire on them, and the empire collapsed soon after. After the Tsar, the provisional government took over and attempted to pass reforms, like in land. However, the new government still struggled to provide food for its urban residents. In late March 1917, they established a grain monopoly to acquire all the grain the peasants were supposedly hoarding. Grain owners were obliged to report their grain to local committees and sell their surpluses at a fixed price. However, the peasants again resisted, and the government largely backed down again. In the end, the provisional government's refusal to withdraw from the war and a continued inability to bring bread back to the cities ended their regime. In October 1917, technically November 1917, but whatever, Lenin and the Bolsheviks come to power. The Bolsheviks took over a country teetering on the verge of total collapse, a complete anarchy. Soon after taking power in October 1917, Lenin issued a decree on peace. It proposed an end to war without the seizure of lands and monetary reparations. Lenin ordered Nikolai Dukhonin, the newly enshrined supreme commander of the Russian army, to cease hostilities and open negotiations. Dukhonin refused, and Lenin immediately replaced him. In November 1917, he invited the war's belligerents to enter into negotiations for peace, but if they did not respond, Russia will negotiate with Germany alone. You can probably say that the Russian army was already then rapidly disintegrating, either because the provisional government's land reforms triggered a rush by the soldiers to return home and claim land, or because of the decree on peace itself. The sudden massive demobilization of 4.5 million soldiers, in addition to civilian refugees, only added to the total chaos engulfing the nation's transportation networks. Anyway, in the end, the Bolsheviks signed a punitive treaty with Germany in March 1918, and the cost of peace was heavy. The empire lost a third of its former population, half of its industry, 89% of its coal deposits, and country-sized tracts of land, including the Russian Empire's former breadbasket, Ukraine. Though I should note that Ukraine was by then no such basket. The Germans expected to get 1 million tons of grain from Ukraine by mid-1918. In reality, they got just 65,000 tons. Germany's later own collapse in November 1918 effectively annulled the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, but the Bolsheviks could not simply reclaim those lost lands because of newly arisen nationalist movements clamoring for their own countryhood. The Red Army had to fight for it. Then unexpectedly, in May 1918, the Czechoslovak Legion mutinied, kicking off the Russian Civil War. The war started slowly, but soon engulfs the entire country, only adding to the government's food headaches. The deterioration of central governmental authority throughout 1917 had only worsened the food crisis in the cities. The trade ties that once linked the city and the countryside were breaking. Without food, urban dwellers either stopped working in the factories or left the cities altogether, returning to their villages. This left labor shortages in the cities, which reduced production of goods like shoes, agricultural machines, and fertilizer. Unable to get these important manufactured goods from the cities, the farmer peasants saw no need to keep providing the cities with food. The Bolsheviks expected the poorer peasants to side with the urban proletariat, meaning the workers who gave only their labor, and give over their grain in solidarity. But when the peasants refused, the Bolsheviks began decrying what they called localism. The second major problem during this time was that the food transportation networks were in shambles. Two-thirds of the locomotives were out of service by 1918, either destroyed, seized, or lost when Ukraine went to Germany. The tracks had fallen into disrepair, with broken rails and washed-out bridges all along the way. There was a massive shortage of labor, skilled labor especially, due to strikes, emigration, and epidemic diseases like typhus. Their inexperienced replacements struggled to keep up with the mass demand, causing jams. That particularly vexed the Bolsheviks. In 1918, problems with the railway networks left 41,000 tons of grain stuck at various stations on the Moscow city perimeter. And then there are the bandits. Wherever the trains stopped, people swarmed to thieve them, with 12,000 incidents reported in a single month. Food officials in Siberia requested full military escorts with machine guns to accompany the trains, saying that rifles can no longer repel the bandits. In January 1918, just 39% of the grain trains setting out from Moscow arrived at their destination. The Bolsheviks came to power because their predecessors could not provide bread for the urbanites. They realize its importance in maintaining social order and power. But in case they needed a reminder, in the spring of 1918, the Bolsheviks' political rivals, the Mensheviks, began a political resurgence, winning elections across many of the country's cities. Lenin comes to believe that this crisis can only be ended by extraordinary measures implemented by a powerful central authority. In March 1918, Lenin declares the first such measure, the Railway Decree. It essentially gave the People's Commissariat for Transport dictatorial powers over the Russian railways. This paves the way for further extraordinary control over other aspects of the economy. On May 8th, Lenin declared a food dictatorship. His party would now conduct a merciless and terroristic struggle and war on peasants deemed to be holding back food surpluses, particularly richer ones, called the kulaks. Armed force was allowed in acquiring these surpluses for the rations to feed the city urbanites. Anyone with a surplus of grain can be imprisoned for 10 years with his possessions seized by the state. This was, in essence, the declaration of a civil war in the Russian countryside. The Bolsheviks first targeted their food dictatorship policies at the few grain-growing areas in European Russia left in their grasp. Throughout the summer of 1918, the intensifying Russian civil war cuts the Bolsheviks off from agricultural heartlands in Siberia, Urals, and the Volga. The food crisis in the cities worsens. To catalog and acquire the grain, Lenin's government first decides to leverage class warfare to pry surplus grain from the prosperous peasants, the kulaks. The government mobilized the poor peasants into committees, kumbed, literally called the committees of the poor, to find and take the grain hidden by these kulaks. By 1918, there were estimated some 122,000 to 139,000 committee members in Soviet Russia. The difficulty in assembling these committees had to do with classification. Kombed members often were landless artisans and hired agricultural workers, people with little social status in the villages. And what defined a prosperous peasant anyway? Lenin believed that every peasant who doubled their consumption, seeds, grain, livestock, was a kulak, a definition so vague that anyone could have qualified. Unable to convince the villages to give up their wheat, the committees of the poor often resorted to violence and terrorism. They became extremely unpopular, triggering much peasant unrest. In the early months of the food dictatorship, the government also forms food requisition brigades called proto-triads. These were paramilitary detachments of armed factory workers and urban residents. They were organized to go into the countryside and work with the committees of the poor to quote-unquote requisition food. They got to keep half of whatever they got. It was essentially legalized robbery. The brigades faced considerable resistance in the villages. Many former soldiers from the army moved home to their villages, fiercely resisting any attempt to steal their food. Sometimes the brigades clashed with groups of Red Army personnel, despite the two theoretically being on the same side. In late 1918, a Red Army group waiting at a train station to go to the front heard that a brigade was nearby. They rushed to that brigade office and began beating the commissar there, shouting that while they were going to the front, these guys were stealing food from their wives and children. Brigades took advantage of their powers, becoming no better than gangs. In one memorable occasion, several occupied the train stations, stopping trains, requisitioning passengers' food, stealing anything not nailed down, and killing anyone standing in their way, including policemen. This disrupted the trains to such an extent that train officials appealed to Lenin directly, who sent people to arrest them. The shortages fed the rise of the black market and smugglers, meshnochniki, or literally, bagmen. Many were ordinary urbanites traveling out to the countryside themselves to barter for food, hitching rides on the trains to do so. A survey in 1919 found that 55% of city households had brought in food from the countryside. But some were very organized and very well armed. These bagmen clashed with brigades or anyone else who tried to stop them from bringing grain into the city. During the summer of 1918, officials in Kursk sent an urgent telegram requesting 5,000 armed men to repel a large infestation of quote-unquote profiteers. In another case in the same area, officials warned that 1,200 former workers from the Bryansk metalworks had abandoned their posts and were making their way to Kursk to get grain, killing anyone they encountered from the food requisition working groups. By August 1918, Moscow's incoming food supplies had declined to just a few railway cars each day. Children were now eating vegetable husks. Desperate, Lenin sends the People's Commissar of Agriculture, Semyon Sereda, to go to the grain-growing regions closest to Moscow, Orel, Voronezh, and Tambov to collect from the harvest. Sereda sets up base in the city of Yelets and sends an expedition to the lands formerly owned by the nobles, now owned by the state, to survey the grain and collect it. Collecting the state-owned grain went all right, though the Soviet expeditions often lacked proper tools for doing so. But acquiring the quote-unquote surpluses personally held by the peasants was far harder. To the peasants, these guys were just another group of bandits coming to their homes and demanding grain. They resisted, even going so far as beating up the officials. Lenin sends constant messages to Sereda to collect the grain surpluses, sometimes berating him for ignoring requests for substantial updates and more grain. On September 17th, Lenin wrote, "You limit yourselves to general and vague comments that often serve to cover total failure of the work. We need exact figures about how much grain has been harvested, collected, and milled." In the end, acquiring these surpluses of grain required careful trading of manufactured goods like nails, shoes, and soap that the peasants wanted. Even then, Sereda's people refused to work without an armed detachment, feeling that they were risking their lives otherwise. Sometimes, even arms were not enough. One time, they approached a village with 30 armed men, but were still forced to retreat when confronted by an enormous crowd. In the end, Moscow and the Bolsheviks pull through its desperate summer thanks to rationing, the black market, and not insignificant small-scale smuggling. Cities lost a third of the population as peasants returned to their villages. What Sereda actually procured only came in September, when the worst had already passed, and fell far short of expectations. But it did show the government how to systematically get the grain surpluses. In November 1918, Lenin abolishes the committees of the poor and sets up this new model across the whole country. In January 1919, the Soviet government announced the policy for armed food requisitions, or Pryodazvoska. The term literally means armed food requisitions, but it more generally refers to the requisition quotas imposed on the various localities rather than the actual activity itself. Food supply officials at the top first determined how much the country needed, and they split that amount up to quotas which were assigned to each province, district, township, and village. Now comes the hard part. The local agents have to collect the required grain. When possible, they tried to offer material incentives to trade with the peasants. Industrial goods were preferred, but often not available in high enough quantities. To make up the gap, officials might pay money, though currency was increasingly useless thanks to the ongoing hyperinflation, or promise the peasants future goods, thusly making the delivered grain a loan. When material incentives did not work, the food procurement officials were authorized to threaten the peasants with force. This force came from the top down. District leaders told the village and township officials that they would be the first arrested if they did not make their quotas or even questioned the quotas. Local officials were encouraged to personally participate in the collection. Throughout 1919, 15-20% of agricultural product was requisitioned from the villages. The next year, that doubled to 30%. Considering that even before the war, the peasants sent 26% of their production to external markets, this was too much. To make the food procurement quota for 1918, peasants had to hand over their seed grain. This, combined with the feeling that the government would take their bread anyway, compromised the peasants' abilities to sow enough land in 1919, causing a significant reduction in how much cropland was cultivated. 1919 amounts were just 60% of what they were pre-war. In response, the food committee officials adjusted their quotas to be based on the amount of sown cropland. Regardless, these quotas were unrealistic. Remember from what I said before, the peasants had already cut their own consumption to provide their surpluses. Yet food procurement officials continued to insist that evil kulaks were hoarding food somewhere in the village. Increasingly squeezed, the peasants slaughtered their livestock and ate traditional famine foods. They baked famine bread from grass, nettle, leaves, acorn, and even sawdust. They ate animal skins, bones, tree bark, clay, roof thatching, and manure. The first reports of cannibalism were emerging as early as spring 1919, when two teenagers attacked and consumed their neighbor. And then the following year, 1920, brought a massive drought that gripped large areas of European Russia, including the central Black Earth and middle and low Volga regions. The winter came early, but with little precipitation. It dried out the peat forests and marshes, sparking hundreds of fires. The drought led to massive crop failures in 1921, 50% declines of output in the Volga Basin. Other areas like Ukraine and the Northern Caucasus suffered as well. Only Siberia had an average harvest. These food requisitions were cruel, and they eventually spread across the entirety of the country, as the Reds gradually prevailed in the Russian Civil War. But the Bolsheviks felt that it was the only way to feed the people in the cities as well as the Red Army fighting the Russian Civil War. By the end of 1920, however, the Soviet government began acknowledging an imminent famine. This and several soldier rebellions, the 1921 Kronstadt Rebellion in particular, caused Lenin to feel that his country needed quote-unquote breathing space. The party ended the forced food requisitions. Instead, they levied a tax on the harvest. Knowing that doing this can cause even more people to fall into hunger, the officials made the amount smaller than what was previously required. Nevertheless, in these early years, the tax was the same old grain requisitioning with a new name. Every gram was hard fought for. Villagers beat and killed tax collection officials, hitting them with clubs and throwing them into the Volga River. Several villages had to be besieged for months. In response, the government set up military tribunals and unleashed paramilitary groups again. The former regularly sent peasants to prison, exile, or death. The latter deteriorated into cruel bandit behavior, torturing, beating, and summarily executing at will. By June 1921, the Soviet government acknowledged that it could not feed the estimated 25 million people suffering hunger. Lenin thus requested help from abroad. The U.S. and Europe responded, though not without conditions. The U.S. government raised $200 million, or $3.4 billion today, to help deliver 4 million tons of relief in Europe. Internally, commissions were set up to provide food to the famine-stricken regions, though sadly, some of the food relief sent to the Volga came from areas that also desperately needed it. Between late 1921 and August 1922, 1,127 trainloads of food were sent from Ukraine to the Volga. Yet the drought had hit Ukraine too, though less ferociously, but no one in the party believed that Ukraine could ever have a bad grain harvest. In Soviet Ukraine, over 3 million people were recorded as being hungry. Travelers recorded that in the worst-hit villages, people were eating their straw roofs, as well as the dogs and cats on the street. In the end, it is estimated that over 5 million people died in the 1921-1922 famine. Horrible things were recorded to have happened, including rampant cannibalism. Children abandoned on the streets, left to be preyed upon by bands of cannibals. I'm not going to show you these photographs, but you can find them online. It's terrible. Areas fell in and out of a state of famine, and it did not fully end until 1924, in part because in 1923 the Soviet government lowered food taxes and finally allowed the peasants to pay them in money rather than their grain. Nevertheless, grain production in 1924-1925 had fallen nearly 40% from 1912-1913. In an effort to give face of a recovery, the Soviet government even began exporting its precious grain in 1923. Truly baffling. Scholars consider this time of forced food requisitions as being part of the ruinous war communism years. Lenin conceded this retreat back to capitalism, but he and the party justified the limited use of markets because the party still controlled what they saw as the quote-unquote commanding heights of the economy, as in its critical parts like heavy industry and banking. In the end, however, he and the Communist Party were still determined to return Soviet Russia to socialism. This retreat to capitalism can only be temporary. But how to deal with the solid resistance of the peasant class? The answers implemented by the Soviets down the line would only cause more suffering. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.